When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party. Today's guest is Kevin Schofield, the political editor of HuffPost UK, or Huffington Post. And we talk about, because Kevin's had a fantastic career working for Scottish newspapers, for UK newspapers, covering politics at Holyrood and at Westminster over a prolonged period of time, and about the political changes, the journalistic changes in that period, working for Rupert Murdoch, and what influence or other he had over The Sun and over The Sun's political coverage during a fascinating period, but also what the most enjoyable things to cover are as a political journalist, and what is his view of politicians and of politics in general, and is he one of those people that can ever imagine himself working for a politician or a political party? This is fantastic chat with someone who is a great talker with a great voice. Now, Kevin is Scottish and he's worked for various Scottish newspapers, and this was recorded a day before Peter Murrell, the former boss of the SNP, was charged by the police. So there's no chat about that in here. So if you think, why on earth are two people obsessed with politics, one of whom is Scottish and talks about the changes in Scottish politics, not mentioning this? It's because we recorded it just before it happened. So apologies for that. But there was really nothing we could do about it. Police Scotland did not let us know. And we will be seeking an apology in due course. But for now, I will stop this incessant waffle. Please enjoy the fantastic Kevin Schofield. Delighted to be joined by Kevin Schofield, the political editor of Huffington Post UK. Or as it's now called, HuffPost UK.
Correct. Yes, it's been that for a few years now, I think. That's the corporate name for it. It's not been Huffington Post for a while.
Okay. So I remember when it was Huffington Post in the mid-noughties, and then a UK version came along. And then, so what is there any sort of political skew to the Huffington Post? Like, if you were at The Sun, we'd know it was right wing. If you were at The Guardian, we'd know it was left wing. Does it place itself anywhere on the spectrum?
Yeah, I'd say it's left of centre, definitely the liberal end of the political spectrum. So we get lots of joy from slagging off the government right now, to be honest with you. They keep us going in copy, day in, day out, by doing lots and lots of silly things. So yeah, I mean, we have lots of fun doing that. So poking fun at Tories really is kind of what we do.
And is there like a house style then? Because obviously the Guardian's left of centre, I guess you could say the Eye or the Independent, whatever it's called now, is in that space. Does Huffington Post think we're going to be a bit more modern? We're going to be a bit more, comedic's not the right word, but slightly more lighthearted?
Yeah, lighthearted, a bit more accessible maybe, less, without wishing to criticise colleagues, obviously, maybe a little bit less po-faced, you know? We just sort of, you know, try to have a bit of fun, really. And it's kind of aimed at a younger audience, although I'm 50 this year, so it's aimed at an audience much, much younger than me. But I don't know, you call them millennials, or what comes after millennials? Is that Gen X?
I think so. I'm a millennial and I'm 41.
Right, okay. Well, yeah, you're kind of right in their target audience, I would say. People who are, like, internet savvy, know about social media, are on social media a lot, I guess online a lot, and that's where they get their news, and it's done in a sort of light-hearted yet accessible way. Quite a lot of stuff we do is stuff that's trending on social media, and we do kind of do it with a bit of a funny slant. So that's it. Yeah, so it's less serious probably than your traditional mainstream media, I would say. But not like, we don't like put up cat videos for clicks or anything like that. You know what I mean? It's sort of, you know, it's still quite, we try to be serious. You know what I mean? We try to have a bit of I don't know what the word is, heft, maybe. You know, because your reputation is important. You know what I mean? You don't want to have the reputation of just being just all nonsense, really, you know? So you kind of do it. You do the serious stories, but with a lighter touch.
Because you're a really funny person. So is this... But you are!
Well, compared to you, I'm not. You're like an actual comedian.
I think many people would say, compared to me, you are. But so is this the ideal gig for you then? Somewhere like that where you can still cover politics in a serious way but have a bit of fun?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you look at I've worked broadsheets and tabloid. I guess tabloid is more fun. And this is, it's done in a sort of tabloidy way. Yeah, no, it's good. Yeah, I tend to have more of a laugh on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, than in my actual job. But you still get to write it in a way that hopefully raises a bit of a chuckle every now and then.
Because you're really the only... I guess there's Politics Joe, and they make their own videos and things. Because the one thing that really fascinates me is obviously was the success of the Guido website.
Yeah.
And I've had Paul Staines on here, and it's fascinating that really the left never had something like that. There was Recess Monkey, and I can't remember, I think there was another attempt at that. But do you think that HuffPost sort of occupies that thing, or is Politics Joe sort of in that space as a kind of left-wing alternative to that?
Yeah, I'd say maybe, yeah, Politics Joe perhaps, you know, is more overtly left-wing than we are. I mean, I think that we shouldn't shy away from slagging off Labour as well when they are, you know, in the wrong, or as we would see it, or they are just making mistakes and what have you. You know, I mean, I don't think they should be off limits by any manner of means. And once they are in government, as everyone expects them to be after the election, then they will be fair game. You know, it's not going to be, I wouldn't want us to be a sort of mouthpiece for the government. That's not what we should be doing. We should be holding them to account and, you know, highlighting any mistakes that they will inevitably make, you know. So it's certainly not, we wouldn't want to be, as I say, a mouthpiece. But at the moment, it's the Tories who are in power, so they're the ones who are getting it with both barrels, and not least because they give you so much ammunition day in, day out.
You're a highly experienced political journalist. Just looking at Labour now. Old and experienced. Old and highly experienced political journalist. Looking at Labour now, I mean, everyone sees the next election as an inevitable win. But what are they getting wrong, do you think? Apart from just the ordinary things that happen to political parties, what are the things that could prevent them getting into number 10?
I mean, I don't see anything now stop them getting into number 10. It's almost like the Tories are actively working to get them into number 10. I mean, it's remarkable. Even today, you know, we've got this latest one with Mark Menzies. It's just, you know, every time that the Tories seem to be just about getting a bit of cut through on the Rayner stuff, maybe, I'm not entirely convinced they are getting any cut through on that. But, you know, they're making things uncomfortable for Labour on that, at least. Then along comes another Tory scandal that completely blows it out of the water, you know. So I don't see anything now. You will never get a Labour person to admit this on the record, but I don't see anything now stopping Labour from winning. But I think what they need to do is give people a reason to vote for Labour, not just vote against the Tories. And, you know, you look at the opinion polls for the Tories are awful, but it's not as if there's a huge wave of enthusiasm for Labour or for Keir Starmer either. You know, I think people are just at that stage now where 14 years of the Tories, it's time to give the other lot a chance. The Tories have messed up, so the only alternative is Labour, so we'll get them in. But I saw a thing earlier this week. There was a polling briefing done by More in Common, the think tank, who are very good. And they'd done about focus groups, and they showed us these clips of a focus group in somewhere in England. And it was one word for Rishi Sunak and then one word for Keir Starmer. And it was pretty interchangeable. I mean, Sunak got hosed for being weak, you know, bad leader, all this stuff. And then think, well, that's bad for him. And then they asked about Keir Starmer, and they were saying pretty much the same things. And you think, well, he is going to be Prime Minister. So he's coming in, and people's expectations are so low, which can be a good thing, really, because it's a very low bar for them to it's not like in 1997 where expectations for Labour were so high that they were never ever really going to achieve what people wanted them to do, whereas now it's so low. Which I suppose you could think, well, they'll come in and even if, you know, as long as they're not crap, people will be like, well, this is better than it was before. But I don't think they're going to get the benefit of the doubt in the way that maybe Blair did for the first couple of years.
The Angela Rayner story then, because some people say, as John O'Farrell did when he was on the BBC at the weekend, this is a Daily Mail story that the BBC then feels duty-bound to cover. And then it spreads it further and people have a perception that Angela Rayner's done something wrong. Taking all the politics out of it, if that's possible, is it a story?
I think it's a story if in that she has made it a story by saying last week, you know, she'll resign as deputy leader if she's found to have broken the law. I mean, that you can't not report that. You know, that is in itself a story. Now, then you get into the nitty-gritty of what she's alleged to have done and what the Tories are accusing her of, and it's such a complicated story to do with electoral roll and capital gains tax and where she lived when. It's a very difficult one to report. Now, I can absolutely get why papers like the Mail and the Telegraph are going after her, because, you know, she would be a big scalp. Even if Labour become the next government, you know, losing a deputy leader is a blow. There's no two ways about it. So it is a story in that, as I say, she's made it a story. But is it one of those ones that has instant cut through with the public? I don't think it is. It's simply because, as I say, it is so complicated. And most people, I think, are willing to give Angela Rayner the benefit of the doubt. She seems to be one of those politicians who's quite popular, you know, unconventional, and is popular with the public. But it would be a blow for Labour if she had to go, because I know from speaking to like senior Labour people that they want her to be front and centre in the election campaign alongside Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer. So, you know, take away one of them, and that is undoubtedly a blow for them.
If you were advising her, would you have advised her to say, I'll resign if I've done something wrong, or would she have been better saying nothing?
I think she would have been better being more upfront about it earlier, and then I think that might have headed it off at the pass, if you see what I mean. I think it got to the stage where they had hoped that it was just going to go away. They tried to dismiss it as smears, politically motivated attacks, nothing to see here, we've done everything right, we're not going to show you the evidence, but you just have to take our word for it. And that didn't work, the story didn't go away, and then they were a bit worried, obviously, and felt like they were backed into a corner a bit, and I think that's why then they've decided to try and take control of the story by saying, a bit like Beergate, where Starmer did exactly the same thing, and Rayner, I think, at the time, you know, they would quit if they were found to have broken COVID rules. So I think it might have been better early doors to say, well, look, here's the advice we got on the tax stuff, electoral roll stuff, whatever. Redact out any sensitive information about living arrangements, kids or anything like that. Here it is. This is what we were told. Now, if I have inadvertently not paid, I think it's £1,500 in capital gains tax, then I will pay it as an ex gratia payment. Here we go. And then I think then I think that would probably have killed it. I think people would have been, well, fair play to you, you know, and compared to millions of pounds that Tories have not paid in tax through tax avoidance, then I think people would have actually should have earned some goodwill from that. But they decided to, I think, stick their head in the sand a bit and hope it would go away, and it didn't. And that's, I think, why they've got themselves into the position where they are.
You're obviously someone who's obsessed with politics and loves covering it. And I'm sure you're very happy in your current post. have you ever considered, and would you ever consider, working for a political party or a politician?
No, it's not something that has ever really appealed. I mean, without getting into details, there's been the odd, you know, approach about various kind of political things, but it's nothing that is. I much and more enjoy chucking rocks over the fence, you know, rather than being on the receiving end. You know what I mean? I just don't. And I don't. I mean, I obviously have political opinions and stuff like that, but I don't. I'm not as tribal. I think you need to be really tribal. You know, you sometimes put yourself in the position of like spin doctors and things, and you think, Well, you're saying that to me, and maybe you do truly believe it, but you must know, you know, you're just spinning a line here. That's not actually right what you're saying. But I think, but if you are to do a job like that, you need to be, you know, 100% card, literally card carrying member of a party, I think. And I've never been that.
Or someone who's talented and thinks working at the center of a major global power is a rare privilege, and you would get to be part of something special, that your skills could be put, those spinning skills, those communication skills could in some way help make this country a better place.
You're a very good salesman, Matt. I've got to tell you, that's, I mean, you feel like that. You're right. And you say, oh, well, you know, you're walking into number 10 every day, for instance, if that was your job, you know, that's cool. But I think it's well, it'd be an absolute pig of a job. You know, I mean, I've got friends who have done it and done really well at it, but you just think, God, you know. But I've seen other colleagues who have gone in there, and it's just completely, they've ended up, you know, they look like they've aged prematurely, you know. I think it's fine maybe when it's going well, but it's rarely going well. There's always another problem around the corner, and it must just be, God, it must be soul destroying sometimes, you know. It's just, and it's never end, especially now. It's 24/7, and you know, I've got a wife, a couple of young kids, and I want to see them. I want to see the kids grow up. I don't want to miss that. So I think it's probably not something for me.
You've been involved in political journalism for over 20 years now. So what is it that attracted you specifically to covering politics in the media?
So my first political job was with the Press Association in Scotland, and that was 2001.
February 2001.
Is that right? Is that when it was?
That's right. February 2001 until April 2004.
Ah, correct. That's right. So I'd always been interested in politics, and I'd enjoyed covering politics in local journalism, you know. It'd always been something that had interested me, but I'd never really thought about being a political correspondent. And I was in a job at the time that I wasn't really enjoying. It was a news agency, and I kind of wanted to get out of that. So a news agency, to put people in the picture, is basically it's like a freelance, you sell stories to the nationals about anything, really anything that you can get them to buy. And the job came up at the Scottish Parliament. It was a friend of mine said, oh, at PACL, there's a job going if you fancy it. We're looking for a political correspondent. I thought, oh, that actually would be quite cool. I'd quite like to live in Edinburgh and cover the Parliament. I think quite exciting. Devolution was quite new at the time. Parliament had only been going a couple of years. And so I went for the job and I got it. And and I just kind of took to it really, really quickly and enjoyed it. Enjoyed the excitement of covering, because it's so unusual, you know, politics. It's like no other type of journalism that you do. And I just found that I got on well with politicians and covering the stuff that they do, the mad stuff that they do, the big important decisions that they do. And I just really, really enjoyed it. So yes, yeah, so I did that for a few years.
And how did the Scottish Parliament feel at that point? Because obviously there'd been the referendum in the late 90s. You're there in the early noughties. It's very, very new, as you say. Would you ever have predicted the sorts of things that have happened in Scottish politics since?
No, I mean, hindsight's a great thing. But then you would never, ever have thought that within, I mean, in a relatively short space of time, really within a decade, pretty much. Well, within, what, the SNP get in 2007? So yeah. Within 6 years, everything had been turned on its head, really. Because at that time, the SNP were a bit of a rabble.
So not much has changed.
Yeah. Well, they were a rabble, then they were good, and now they've gone back to being a rabble again. So it's kind of gone full circle. But Labour were like the dominant party in Scotland, had been for a very long time. The electoral system had been designed in such a way up there, basically, to keep the SNP out. It had been cooked up by Labour as a system that effectively they thought would guarantee, you know, permanent Labour Lib Dem coalition. How did that work? So at that time, yeah, everything seemed to be going to that plan. You know, the Labour were pretty fair, and also the fact that there was a Labour government down here with Tony Blair, so they were working collaboratively. There was no tension really. It was the odd thing, but nothing really. They were working hand in hand. But yeah, I mean, you forget, you didn't really appreciate, really, at that time, it looked like Labour were going to be in for forever, north and south of the border, but obviously very quickly politics changes. And it's probably got more interesting since I moved down here, really. So I came down to London in 2008. So the SNP were in power, but there was no prospect of independence referendum. All that's happened subsequently. So that would have been a really exciting time to actually be in Scotland covering it. But I managed to get up to cover it a bit, but it would have been really exciting to be there throughout that particular constitutional battle.
And what's your view of it in terms of a cohort of politicians, Holyrood? Do you think it's kind of helped develop talent, or do you think that the big talent still in Scottish politics go to Westminster?
I think certainly Labour politicians probably see Westminster as the place where they really want to be, Scottish Labour politicians. And that's not to try and denigrate those that are in Scotland. And as I said, I've been away for a long time, so I wouldn't want to criticise them because I'm not really covering it very much. But I certainly knowing like your SNP politicians as well. I mean, obviously Nicola Sturgeon, big, big beast, John Swinney, they're up there. But, you know, they've got good people down here as well. Although in saying that, the quality of politicians at Westminster is not that great either, if you're being honest. You know, we're not in a golden generation, certainly, compared to maybe a few decades ago. So, yeah, we tend to maybe look down our nose a little bit on the Scottish Parliament, which I think is really unfair. I think there are a lot of good politicians up there. But Westminster is probably still seen, certainly for unionist politicians at least, as the place to be. That's where the real power lies.
There are some exceptional politicians in the Scottish Parliament. I guess you're right, in any assembly or parliament you can think of in the UK, that there's a mix of quality that reflects what's happened to political parties in the last decade or so, in terms of their leadership and the sorts of parliamentary candidates they were then recruiting based on that.
Yeah.
Frankly, some of the quality control has been appalling.
Well, there's loads of, I mean, because I think part of that's to do with the fact that the public are so volatile now that parties are winning seats that they probably never thought they were going to win. And so the candidates that they've chosen in these seats weren't ever expected to become MPs or MSPs, you know, but they suddenly find themselves there. And they quickly get found out. So I think that is definitely the case, both here and in Scotland, you know. But I just think it's a really tough job. I would never want to be an MP or an MSP. I just think it's become an even more difficult job than it was before, partly because of social media. I think they're never off. But I think the expectations on politicians now are massive. And the scrutiny is huge, which I think is a good thing. But I just think it's a thankless job.
And what's your starting point with politicians then? Do you think you admire anyone who stands for office and gets elected and can get things done? Or as a journalist, do you think, oh, these people are up to something and I'm gonna catch them out?
Yeah, I mean, some of my colleagues are in that camp. I'm not. My instinct is that maybe I'm being a bit naive, but my instinct is, you know, fair play to them for wanting to do it. I think by and large, it's not uniform, but I think by and large, they're in it for the right reasons. They're in it because they think they can make a difference. They think they can serve their areas. And they're ambitious. Loads and loads of them want to be prime minister, obviously, or want to be cabinet ministers. But no, I don't think that they're all on the take or anything like that. But that's, it'd be ridiculous to try and suggest that they're all holier than whole and whiter than white. It's obviously not the case. But I think the vast majority are pretty decent people.
You've been based at the Scottish Parliament for various publications and you've been in the lobby on and off for a few years. What's the journalistic cultural differences between covering Scottish politics as part of effectively a Scottish lobby and covering UK politics at that level as well?
Well, I mean, bear in mind again that I left Scotland 16 years ago. The difference I find is that, I mean, there are a lot of similarities. I think the lobby north and south of the border is very collegiate. You know, although we work for rival publications, we all share rooms with one another, which is something that a lot of people might think quite unusual, you know. So when I first came down, I came down with the Daily Record, which is a left of centre Labour paper, or certainly was then in Scotland. And I shared a room with The Sun, which in Scotland is the Daily Record's arch enemy. Different down here. So I shared an office with The Sun, Evening Standard, Channel 4, ITN. So we all work literally next to one another, but we're also theoretically rivals. But there's a lot of collaboration. You're obviously still trying to get your own stories, but there's a lot of stuff where you help one another out because you're all sort of in it together, really. So there is that. I think the Scottish lobby was just a bit smaller, inevitably, because Scotland is smaller. But in terms of the atmosphere, it's part of the thing that attracts me to the job is that everyone gets on pretty well. There's no one who you really dislike. Everyone, as I say, helps one another. We all have our own sort of political agendas to follow, perhaps, you know, right-wing papers, left-wing papers, whatever. But ultimately, we're all chasing the same thing, which is stories, and try to hold the powerful to account.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Do the National have a lobby correspondent in Westminster?
They do. Really nice fella called Hamish. He's a really nice guy. He's not been down that long, maybe about a year or so. But that's one thing, actually, the Scottish lobby itself down here has really just withered on the vine. So when I first came down, I was at the Record, the Scotsman had at least two people, the Herald had a couple of people, the P&J, the Press and Journal, had someone, the Dundee Courier had someone, and now, so they had their own room. I wasn't in it, but there was the Scottish lobby room. So it was the Herald, Scotsman, P&J, Courier, all in the one room. And now they don't even have a room. They don't have, it's really sad, actually. One of the really sad elements of is the Scotsman still got a guy. The Herald, I don't think I've got anyone now down here. P&J and Courier definitely don't. It's good that the National do. The Record still does. Scotsman's got one guy. But that's it. So it's really sad. But I think that's partly a byproduct of the Scottish Parliament is now, for the Scottish media, is obviously the centre of power, whereas Westminster is obviously less important. And also, circulations have declined, so it's not obviously commercially viable maybe for them to have lobby correspondents at Westminster, but I still think that's a great shame, especially considering if Labour win the election and they get lots of Scottish Labour MPs elected, there's going to be a lot of very powerful Scottish Labour MPs down here, you know, in government positions. And it'll be a shame that there's no Scottish journalists here, or not many Scottish journalists to hold them to account.
So when you've got someone like Hamish from The National, who is maybe more explicitly political than even some of the other tabloid journalists that he's sat around, and is in the heart of a place that he's absolutely committed to leaving. Can that create tensions?
No, I don't think so. And I honestly don't even know what Hamish's personal politics are, and I would never ask. But no, it doesn't. I mean, he's doing his job. His paper obviously is very pro-independence. So he's obviously going to be maybe even more critical of the Tories, or more critical of Scottish Labour, obviously, as well, and he'll toe, I guess, the SNP line. But no, I don't think it really creates tension. The thing to remember is that the bottom line is our job is to get stories. Our job is to keep our news desks happy, keep our editors happy. And as long as you're doing that, then it's fine. And I think everyone's grown up enough to realise it's all about the game. I'll give you an example. This week. So there's a special advisor, Jeremy Hunt special advisor, a guy called Cameron Brown, lovely big fella, and he deals with the media on behalf of Jeremy Hunt. He's leaving. And he sent out a WhatsApp message, obviously on a group, basically to say, I'm leaving, thanks for everything, having a leaving drinks here, blah, 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 come along if you can. And I replied to him saying, look, just want to say you've been great to work with. I've never written a good thing about your boss, but you've always answered the phone to me. You've always replied to my text messages, and I really appreciate that. And he goes, well, the game is the game, which is it, you know what I mean? So, which is a grown-up, I think, really professional attitude to take, even though he would never get me writing a piece saying Jeremy Hunt's fantastic, because that just wouldn't work for us. But he always answered the phone to me, and he always gave me a line when I asked for one. He always gave me a briefing when I asked for one. And ultimately, we are all grown-ups. So I think that's the right approach. We should, even if you don't see eye to eye politically, ultimately, we're all still doing the same job in a certain extent, which is, as I keep saying, holding the powerful to account, covering politicians, letting people know what they're up to. And I think that that's probably the way to approach it.
I think most people find it heartening to imagine that journalists from all different publications can coexist together and have quality and reasonable relationships. Is there a danger, though, with that, that you effectively get a cohort of political correspondents who are all a little bit cosy, and then you get a bit of groupthink and you might lose sight of perhaps where the public is?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I completely get that. And I think that's a fair criticism, and it's something that we always have to guard against. There can be a sort of Westminster village attitude that you have to be careful. You've always got to try and think, well, hang on a minute, what would normal people think about this? You know, we always talk about, like, oh, that story's a bit too insidery, it's a bit too beltway. Things that we tend to get obsessed about, actually, normal. Or we get obsessed about, Twitter gets obsessed about, largely because we're all on Twitter, so we're all just talking to each other all the time. And you forget, actually, ordinary punters don't give two shits about something that we think is, like, the biggest story on the planet, you know? So you always have to kind of check yourself and make sure that you're not falling into that trap. We don't always succeed, absolutely not. But I would say this, but I think on balance, we probably get it right most of the time, but there are occasions where you don't, and you have to be very wary of that.
So is Twitter actually more of a risk than being part of the lobby itself in terms of groupthink or maybe getting distracted by the things that aren't such a priority?
I think, definitely. I mean, we all seem to sort of live our lives on Twitter. As much as we criticise it now that we Elon Musk, you know, it's not as good as it was, and there's a lot of more bots and crazies on it than there were before. But we're still on it all the time. We're probably part of the crazies, you know. We're just on it, and we, because, well, MP, for a start, you get so many stories from it, because MPs now, instead of putting out a press release, they'll just put a statement or a video on Twitter. So you have to be on it to see stuff like that. But the flip side of that is that you then can easily fall into the trap of thinking, oh, because something's had lots of likes or lots of retweets, it must be dead important to normal people. But my mum and dad aren't on Twitter. You know, most normal people aren't. So you have to be very wary of falling into that trap.
What was your take on the way that particularly the Tories have used social media? I think maybe Labour are getting into that space now. There was a whole discussion a few years ago about shitposting. This idea was that they would deliberately put out things that were naff or bad in order for everyone to make a fuss and then amplify the message. I mean, that still to me feels like a counterproductive thing to be doing and a not very grown-up thing for a political party to be doing. I know there are online cultures and appealing to young people and having a sense of humour is something that I would absolutely defend. But do you think, one, I mean, I'm thinking specifically actually of that Tory tweet the other day about Britain being the second best country in the world and it had the England men's team on it. So much wrong with it. Is it just that was just crap? Or do you think, oh, they've done it crap on purpose so that we talk about it?
I mean, yeah, it's difficult to know whether you're being spun, but they ended up having to take it down, which makes me think, I think they just realised it was shit. You know, if they did, if it was genuinely just to wind people up and get it talked about and written about, then why take it down? Why not just leave it up there? I think in that occasion, I think they realised that they'd got it wrong. But there are other ones that they do, I think, are even worse. You know, like it's proper misinformation. So there was the one a week or two ago on the back of Keir Starmer's interview with Harry Cole on Nevermind the Ballots, the Sun TV thing. And he was asked if he would put up taxes. And his answer was, well, I've already said I'll put up taxes on, you know, closed loopholes and non-doms. And it was stuff, you know, put up tax on private schools, all that type of stuff. He went on to say that. But the Sun, the Tories just put out a tweet, basically him cutting it after him saying, well, of course I'm going to put up taxes, point par, that's it. Which is, you know, typical Labour, they said, or something like that. And you think, well, wait a minute, you've completely removed all the context of the rest of the answer, which... that to me is much more corrosive than just putting out something that's a bit crap and naff. But then Rishi Sunak re-repeated it at the dispatch box yesterday. And I think, man, that's just taking it to a whole new level. Not only is it misinformation on social media, but the Prime Minister at the dispatch box is saying it. And I think that is that's dodgy. I mean, there was the other one they did on Sadiq Khan, where he talked about, was it he talked about Labour and anti-Semitism? And he says, oh, Labour is an anti-Semitic party. Then he corrected himself and said, no, we're not an anti-Semitic party. But they just put out a clip, the Tories put out a clip saying, of Sadiq Khan saying, Labour is an anti-Semitic party. And he says, Labour haven't changed. But it was a complete misrepresentation of what he'd actually said, which I think if the next 6 months of the election campaign is going to be like that, then it's going to be absolute bin fire, you know. If that's what they're reduced to having to do, then it's going to be a really, really grim campaign.
What is the lobby view on Rishi Sunak?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I think we're all pretty much in tune with the public, in that I think my personal view is that, you know, I think he thought the job would be a lot easier than it is. I think he thought, well, let's trust me, such a mess yet. And I've been proved right. Everything I said would happen if she became leader has happened. So I'll come in, I'll undo all that stuff, and things will be fine. And I'll get lots of credit for it. And I'll do that for a couple of years, get the opinion poll ratings up, get into the campaign, hunky-dory. I think it hasn't turned out like that. I think he's turned out to be just really, really bad at politics. I think that is the general view in the lobby. A lot of the decisions that he makes, a lot of the things that they do, just don't make a lot of sense, and you don't know what the strategy is. And the worse things get, the more daft things they do, because they're desperately just trying to reclaim the narrative and get on the front foot, and just nothing is working. Partly, or mainly, I think, because the public have already made up their minds. And it wouldn't really matter who was Prime Minister now. I think after 14 years, the public are just sick of the Tories. And after 14 years, you've made so many mistakes. There are so many skeletons in the cupboard. There are just so many things that you can't blame on the previous government, because you've been in power for such a long time. You have to carry the can, and eventually the public just think, we're just fed up with you. That's why, you know, I mean, Jeremy Hunt's been cutting national insurance, and it's made not a blind bit of difference. But the Tories still seem to think that all we need to do is just keep cutting tax, and everything will be fine. But it's just not working. Just people have switched off. They've already moved on mentally. They want an election. They want to change the government and see how Labour do. There's no great enthusiasm for Labour, I don't think, but they just want to give the other lot a chance and see how it goes.
Yeah, I mean, any prolonged period of time covering British politics, you would have seen momentous events and scandal. But what has been, do you think, the most exciting time in your career politically?
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt, for me, it would be the Scottish independence referendum. Just being Scottish, you know, it was personal as much as anything, you know. I mean, I didn't have a vote because I live in London, but I was up there covering it. I was at the Sun at the time. And it was quite funny because the Sun in London was very pro-unionist and the Sun in Scotland was not. Although in the final day, they didn't come out to say vote yes. They kind of hedged their bets. But so that was quite... And so I got sent up, I think, maybe a week before. So working out the Glasgow office, which was... It was just great. It was so exciting. You know, everything that was going on, the whole place was just like... alive, you know, it's in a way that politics rarely captures the public's imagination, really, other than like, you know, general elections to a certain extent. But this was different, you know, this was like, wow, you could be on the edge of absolute, you know, complete, proper change, you know, an independent country. So, yeah, that was, and there was the poll maybe about a week or so out which said, yes, we're in front. That was the only poll which showed that, yes, we're in front. But, you know, it was definitely all up in the air. It was all to play for in the final few days. And you genuinely did not know how it was going to go until the results started to come in.
How did you manage that difference then between the Sun in Scotland and the Sun based in London with that political difference?
I mean, it was quite easy, really. It didn't really change the way I approached the job. I mean, like, I'll give you an example. So the day before the poll, Gordon Brown gave that famous speech. I think it was in Govan, I think he might have been, or maybe not. Anyway, I can't remember what it was, but he was in this hall and he was on the platform. Ruth Davidson was there, Joanne Lamont, who was a Scottish Labour leader at the time, and Brown, you'll remember it's famous speech, and Brown just came out and just blew the roof off the place. I mean, it was one of those ones you're like, wow. You know, regardless, I think, of where you were on the question itself, it was just an astonishing political performance. No notes, just prowling, you know, the way Gordon does, prowling up and down the stage, you know, he's doing that with a hand, you know, I mean, he's just amazing, like a preacher. It was fantastic. And it was just, that in itself, I think, was just a great story. It was just him, really, obviously his great line was, the silent majority will be silent no more. I think that was maybe the first line of the speech, and the place just went bananas. And it was just like, wow. And I remember the headline in the Sun the next day, the English edition was, Iron Brun. Which, yeah, clever. Right. So I think that was, you just wrote what he said, and you wrote it pretty much impartially, because it was just so powerful, the words were, you didn't really have to be saying you agreed with him or not. It was just powerful political oratory. So it was the editorial, the leader column had they kind of put the politics out there of where the paper stood. And obviously we wrote stories which were probably more slanted towards the unionist side than the yes side. But I didn't feel like I was going up there like a sort of spy in the camp or anything like that, or, you know, up there campaigning for no or anything like that. It was just that you knew what the job was. As I said earlier, the job was to keep the news desk happy, keep the editor happy, and you write your copy in a way that's going to get a good show in the paper, basically. But I got on really well with the guys up. I mean, the Glasgow office was like Scotland, you know. There was yes supporters, there were no supporters. Everyone was engaged to an amazing degree, and that was undoubtedly the most exciting. I mean, I couldn't vote, but I walked to the polling station with my mum and dad the next morning, because you just felt that you were, you know, part of history, you know, and you genuinely did not know how it was going to go until the first results started to come in. Then it was pretty obvious who'd won. But it was still such an exciting time. And Alex Salmond resigns the next day. It was just, oh, it was great. If I could relive any moment in my career, it would definitely be that one, more so that than Brexit or general elections or anything like that. That was the biggie.
Just thinking about that different emphasis in Scotland and in England, is that proof that actually papers follow opinion rather than lead it? And thinking maybe specifically about the Sun and its effect or not on certain momentous general elections and polls.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, I mean, the Sun in particular, I think, has always maybe overplayed its influence. You know, the Sun won it and all that type of stuff. It would be so interesting to see how they couch it in the general election, given, you know, it seems pretty inevitable that Labour are going to win. They tend to like to back winners rather than losers. So, but yeah, it was interesting, you know, again, the Scottish Sun had been very pro-nationalist for a year, pro-SNP for a long time. But yeah, when push came to shove that day, they sat in the fence because I think they knew it was so tight that the country was split, so they didn't want to go one way and or another in case they called it wrong. So it was a bit easier for the English son because, well, we weren't involved in a way. In a way, it wasn't our fight because we were in England, although it was our fight because it was the whole of the UK, if you know what I mean. But it was much more important for the son in Scotland to call it right, and in the end, they decided not to call it at all.
What's your view on newspapers and their future and their health?
I mean, it's pretty grim, unfortunately. I mean, I'm a newspaper man, you know, to my boots. You know, that was 30 years I've been a journalist, and it started off in newspapers. And at that time, you thought newspapers would be around forever, obviously, before the internet came along and completely just changed the whole approach to news gathering and reporting. But I'd love to think there is a long-term future for newspapers, but you can't argue with the evidence in front of your face. I mean, you've only got to be on the tube in the morning. There's never anybody reading a paper. Not one. Which I think tells its own story. I get a paper on a Saturday and a paper on a Sunday. I don't buy a paper during the week either, and I love newspapers. So I just don't see, eventually, I mean, I still hesitate to say one day there'll be no newspapers, because I still think there is something really good about having a physical product in your hand. But it can't compete with online for the immediacy of news, you know what I mean? So there's no point picking up a paper and just reading what was on Twitter the day before. It's like, well, I've already seen that, so why should I bother buying it? So I can understand why people don't want to buy newspapers, but it's difficult to see a long-term... Certainly, there wouldn't ever be a return to the good old days of mass circulation or anything like that, but yeah, it's grim. And the fewer journalists there are, I know a lot of people on Twitter will rejoice, oh, blah, 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 MSM, this, that, and other. But you'll miss us when we're gone, you know, because who's going to hold the purple to account? Who's going to cover boring council meetings? Who's going to cover court, you know, to make sure that justice is being delivered and that people aren't being banged up unjustly? All this type of thing that you need journalists there, you need the public representatives in there keeping an eye on the powerful. And, you know, a guy sitting in his pants on Twitter isn't going to be able to do that, I'm afraid. So that's the way it is. So it's a tough old business. A lot of journalists have lost their jobs this year as well. You know, it's a tough game at the moment.
And is there not a way to still have online versions of all these things? They all have websites and they've all got different models of funding them, but with the same level of staffing?
Well, I mean, it's all about how do you pay for it? You know, I mean, I think the Times have got a great website. They've got seems like a good business model in terms of the subscription model. Telegraph seems to do okay, I think. But I think it's still a struggle to generate the money that is required to do the job properly. And we've seen it, even big newspapers are cutting back on numbers of journalists, or they're going to 7-day operations. Their Sunday papers are merging with the daily paper, you know, rather than, so they can, in theory, they don't need as many members of staff. And that's your big titles are doing that, you know. So it's, as I say, it's tough. And the internet's been around for how long now, and yet we've still not cracked a business model that absolutely works in the way that the old newspaper one did, with the advertising and the cover price and all of that, and it all worked and there was lots of money around. The online, still the free with adverts works up to a point, subscription works up to a point, but no one has, I think, yet nailed the optimum way of making the internet, journalism on the internet, pay.
You were at the Sun for 5 years, chief political correspondent. Did you ever meet Rupert Murdoch?
The closest I ever got to Rupert Murdoch was I was in a lift with him purely by accident. I was at HQ one time. He was over and he'd done some address to the troops or something like that. And I got into a lift with a colleague and we were in the lift, and then Rupert and I think James, his son, was there as well. He was around at the time. They came in, and it was one of those weird moments, like they came in and obviously turned around to face the doors like you do in a lift, and we were behind them, and I'm looking at my pal like, you know, that's Rupert. That was it. Obviously, I didn't speak to him, and I never ever saw him. I think it was the only time. He was never in the lobby room. I spent most of my time in Parliament, so when he came over, he was in HQ, so I never actually saw him.
And how much of what he said or what he wanted would filter into the day-to-day? Was it a guiding philosophy? What would Rupert think or what would Rupert want us to say?
I mean, maybe back at HQ, I mean, you certainly knew when he was in town, you know, when he'd fly in and they'd be like, oh, KRM, as he was known, KRM, Keith Rupert Murdoch, KRM's in town. So it was always a case of, you know, there's more pressure to get exclusives, you know, to impress the boss. You know, we have to have something that's a really big scoop or whatever. So there's a wee bit more pressure, but you never ever got a phone call, Rupert wants this, so you better write it this way. That never happened when I was there.
Kevin, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on.
You're very welcome. It's flown in. Absolutely flown in. It's been great fun. I could talk all day to you, Matt, as you know.
Well, we shall have to do it again.
There you go, the fantastic Kevin Schofield. You can follow him on Twitter at Kevin A. Schofield. I've put a link to him as well in the blurb so that you can easily do it at the click of a finger. Thank you so much for downloading this. Please leave a 5-star written review and tell all your friends about it. And I'll be back next week with another fantastic guest. Ta-ra.